Hello and welcome to the Rules of Investing podcast. My name's James Marley, co-founder of Livewire Markets, and I'm standing in for your regular host, Patrick Polk. Today we've got something special for you. It's an interview featuring Hamish Douglas from Magellan Financial Group and Andrew Clifford, who's the CIO and CEO at Platinum Asset Management. These two firms don't need much of an introduction, and I'm sure you're going to get a lot out of the discussion today. We'll talk about some of the differences and similarities between their investing styles, and then go deep into where they think the best opportunities exist in global markets today. I really hope you enjoy the recording, and as always, remember to subscribe to the podcast, give it a like, and share it with anyone that you know who you think will enjoy this podcast. That's it from me, and let's get into the discussion. When I was doing some background reading, I was knowing that we've got the two firms, we've just talked about complementary styles. That also means that there's a difference in approach and a difference in philosophy. How would you two see the divergence and the similarities between the way that you invest? My take was like more of a value folk, like a deeper value contrarian focus from Platinum, and Hamish from the recordings and the reading I've done recently, I feel like I'm getting a sense that the quality of the business and the hurdles for that growth trajectory that the business are on is a bit more paramount in your process.
Yeah, we won't do sort of contrarian deep value type investing. We tend to invest in super high quality. We do take, within that, we will take a contrarian position. Often your best ideas are contrarian, but they're not classically would be styled as sort of the contrarian play. So I think that's slightly different. I think Platinum's more diversified in terms of the number of holdings. We tend to take very concentrated, single stock, specific type risk. Yep. Well, I think Platinum takes less of that single stock type risk. They don't end up with 7% of the portfolio in a single name.
That's right.
So the absolute concentration is different. We have obviously got expertise and things in different. We've been more US-centric, they've been more Asian-centric in their portfolios. I think they'll be more classically in the value bent in terms. But everything comes to value, so I find this misnomer about they're probably more contrarian in the style than we're all looking at value at the end of the day. So this concept of value investing is something that just takes itself to one or the other. It's stupid.
I'm more and more object to the label of value, because if you're not a value investor, then you're not investing. You're actually just speculating, right? Because, I mean, everything comes to us. Everything comes down to price. But, you know, value gets associated with low PEs, low price to book. And you could have a low PE and a low price to book and be terrible value. Or you can actually, you know, be a very highly rated stock and we think represent great value. And I think the
interesting thing, when we bought Visa and MasterCard, they were at 15 times earnings or something, and we thought they were dirt cheap.
Yep.
But the value investors say, well, they're never going to be low price to book because they don't have any books.
but they're good examples. I mean, we at the time were doing the work on those because they were, at the time you were buying them, they're out of favour because some of the regulatory changes going through. So we do like to have that present, that sense that, you know, there's something concerning people about the company. But we do end up from time to time in the same stock. So I think we were both in eBay and then PayPal as it spun out. And
I think you both own Facebook at the moment.
And, you know, we've come to Facebook, like, we were watching it very closely for a long time and then, you know, hadn't acted on it. And we had the Cambridge Analytica initial sell-off and bought it then, and then have bought it again after the sort of reset on earnings.
But it's interesting, when we first got into Facebook was probably a year and a half earlier than that, when they gave a warning about that they were going to have less ad load and the market sold off dramatically.
Yep.
And we weren't, so ours was a bit of a contrarian entry point.
Yep.
Platinum just came to a contrarian point. It was another contrarian entry point as well.
But I think, you know, we do end up in some of the same stocks some of the time, but we probably just are prepared to go what we would talk in terms of quality, so we're prepared to go down to more cyclical sort of
where
stocks.
Where we won't. We're just very strict on the quality that we'll own.
Yeah.
And we're not saying which is right or wrong. It's just a a style.
And it goes a bit to our sort of lesser concentration, because we always sort of look at people who run very concentrated portfolios, and for us we'd say, you know, sometimes those strongest ideas are actually our worst, right? Because you didn't identify what, if you could have such a strong view on it, you haven't identified what's making you uncomfortable. And for us, we feel like you've got the good calls or the ones that are very uncomfortable, not the ones that are easily done. So, you know, we do prefer to have that sort of broader spectrum of stocks. Having said that, you know, it's still a relatively concentrated portfolio by many people's standards.
But. Yeah, but that the nature of the cyclicality of the businesses that you own, you need that bit of diversification just to cushion the ones that don't work out. Is that right?
I think that you just don't have the high, you know, when you're investing at the very high quality end of the spectrum, you can have greater certainty about the future outcomes. But, you know, it's not for us. At the moment, we own quite a lot of cyclical type businesses because that's where the market, we think, is throwing up the great opportunities. But, you know, there have been other times where we've been, you know, completely at the other end of the spectrum, depending on what's going on in markets and in the world.
Well, talking of markets and the world, there's the annual, you know, Christmas comes, people take a bit of a breather, but it was also quite an interesting time with the Fed effectively doing an about turn on their policy and the narrative around that. People in the latter part of last year were factoring in continued steady rate hikes, and they did an about face. How meaningful has that change in stance been for things like confidence and how you're sort of viewing the trajectory for equities from here? Hamish, you can start with that, and Andrew, you come on in.
Well, James, you're absolutely right. It was a massive backflip by the Fed at the end of January. And I don't think many people were expecting the extent of the backflip. Obviously, in the very latter part of last year, financial conditions did tighten, but we had a big sell-off in markets as well. I actually think Davos probably influenced with Dalio and others in Davos saying that they're going too fast, they need to slow down, they're going to cause another recession, we're very worried about how late cycle we are. Of course, we have Trump who's out there calling on the Fed, and then they come out, you're not only right, they backflipped in terms of somebody inserting the word patient, and that was last used back in early 2016. Mm-hmm. So this feels to me like 2016. They started tightening rates in December 15, and then at the beginning of 16, they got spooked by China, really about their foreign currency reserves, and they put any rate increases on pause for a period of time. And the markets took that as a signal that low rates are here and 2016 happened. So it eerily feels like 2016 again. But very importantly, they also mentioned the balance sheet. They haven't told us what they're going to do, but they said they may well change the pace of quantitative tightening.
Yeah.
And end it earlier than previously was being anticipated. And I think that's far more material in the news. So really the punch bowl's been handed back to the markets, and we've actually seen, if you look at flows around the world, flows into EMs, flows into high yield, and probably riskier areas of the market, there's been a very risk on trade, as in this party's going to continue. You know, my sort of warning to people here is none of us know what's going to happen. They've probably given us another 6 months before really knowing where it goes from here. Are we going to continue this very low inflation world, and then the Fed just can continue this pause effectively on without having to worry about inflation? I don't know. At the end of the day, we haven't really seen inflation yet, but that doesn't mean it won't happen. It kind of reminds me back of July 2007, this environment. And the reason I'm picking July is because that's when Chuck Prince, who's the CEO of Citigroup, made his very famous statement. He goes, you know, when the music's still playing, you've got to get up and dance, and we're still dancing. And at the way what Powell has done is actually said the music's still playing.
Yeah.
I just think it's very risky to say then it's compulsory to dance.
Right.
I think it's incredibly uncertain. So it doesn't surprise me that the markets have reacted since January and into February as they have. It looks some of this trade dispute may well get taken off the table. We don't know. China seems to have steadied its situation somewhat, and the Fed has said the punch bowl is back and risk is back on.
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree with most of with all that Hamish is saying, but I think the thing that's getting missed here all the time in all this analysis is We're focusing on US rates. We're focusing on the US economy. It's what we've done for the last 30 years. But China today, second largest economy, but it's the biggest market in any physical good you can think of, from shoes to planes to trains. It's a huge market. So it is just, I think, very similar to 2016 in the sense that China had a huge tightening of monetary policy back then caused by the capital outflows. What we saw a year ago was this financial reform, a huge tightening of the availability of money, and you can see it in Chinese interest rates. So, I mean, if I ask someone, where's the Chinese 10-year bond, who's going to tell me, right? Or short rates. But Chinese bonds had gone from, the 10-year yields had risen from, you know, a bit below 3 to around 4.5 a year ago. And short rates had similarly gone above 5. So we'd actually inverted the yield curve in China. Now, they don't manage their monetary policy really in that fashion. It really reflects other things that are going on. But here we had an inverted yield curve in this economy, and guess what happened? It slowed, and it slowed in a way, in quite a different way to what we've seen before, because it's been a much more of a consumer-focused slowdown as some of that credit that was finding its way into that market, particularly through peer-to-peer lending, was taken away. So what have we got now? 10-year yields in China are back down around 3. Short rates are below 3. And we've got a fiscal, again, in China, one of the problems is transparency. But all of the policies, the best analysis that's out there suggests that, you know, we once again have a fiscal stimulus to the tune of about 3%. This time more through tax cuts than spending. You know, I think the place, you know, we never do know what's going to come next, but in the way the systems of the world work, you'd expect China's going to look a little bit better this year. We've taken away the US tightening. But again, we are late cycle in the US, perhaps not so much in the rest of the world. You know, it's an interesting sort of circumstances we face this year.
So you've got to vote with your feet. Given the changes that have taken place over that 12-month period that you've talked about with Chinese rates, what we talked about happening in the US, have you dialed up the exposure in the portfolio? I know when we caught up last year, I think it was sitting around 80% exposure in your portfolio. Have you increased the risk that you're taking?
No, what we've really done is change within that portfolio. So as we've had the sell-off later in the year, you know, there are some really great stocks, very cheap, particularly in the semiconductor area. And the one I like to highlight, you know, we've often talked about Samsung, but, you know, Micron, you know, it's one of the three players in DRAM, one of the five players in flash memory. Most incredible science at the heart of this company or these companies. A very, you know, now consolidated market. The same incentives aren't there to invest in capacity, in DRAM at least. It's at the centre of every exciting technology from, you know, whether it's Facebook or it's autonomous vehicles, and you can buy it at book value. And they're promising to buy back a quarter of their stock at the lows. Now, the stocks have had a good bounce off there, but, you know, it was extraordinary value in a lot of these cyclical tech areas. So what we were doing is more going, okay, well, you know, we've been progressively leaving, you know, positions in other parts of tech, which we think not particularly expensive, but, you know, didn't offer that same sort of opportunity. So whether that was Alibaba in China, or we've, you know, been selling down and are out of PayPal, which, you know, we still think they're great companies and they have lots of opportunities, but we thought this, you know, represented a lot more. So, you know, the market exposure is similar to what we had, a little bit lower than that 80% at the moment, but a lot of movements underlying the surface.
Hamish, similar style question for you. In that period in the last quarter of 2018, there was a big drawdown, you know, particularly in the US index, and it's bounced back. But you were carrying 18% or so cash at that time. With that kind of dislocation in the market or short-term drawdown, did you find some compelling ideas? Did you feel pressed to put some money to work given some of the changes we talked about at the macro level as well with rates and the punch bowl being served back up?
Yeah, at the margin, at the end of the day. And why I say it was at the margin, There was a whole series of things that we were looking at, and frankly, January ran very strongly. So we are less than, we got up to 20% cash. We are we're less than that. We're probably around 16% cash, slightly less than that. So we've deployed some cash. Don't forget, we're super high quality. We tend to not play the technology cyclicals, for instance. I'm not critical at all, but that's not in our sort of quality filter of what we'd play. But a number of things had sold off very dramatically. I'm not going to tell people what we've bought. There has been some trading within the portfolio as we saw as well. Some things we were buying, then they ran past our price limits where we feel comfortable in this market.
Yeah. So at 16% and cash, and Andrew, that relatively, so a bit below 80%, that tells me that despite some opportunities coming up at the stock specific level, you're both still relatively cautious and circumspect about the outlook for where we are in markets. Is that a fair summation?
I struggle a bit with drawing that conclusion from our positioning, because to me, the positioning comes about the opportunities in the stocks.
Right.
So I'm extraordinarily excited about the opportunities in our stocks. And to me, in the world we're in, and I'm talking long term, not the next 12 months, I think as a portfolio positioning thing, you want to run through time with cash of probably 15%, because opportunities arise, and if you don't have cash, you're not going to be able to take advantage of it. So I don't even see that as being particularly, I think there's lots of issues that will come out of left field and hurt markets over the next 5 years. But in the meantime, we're buying the stocks we want to buy, have a few interesting short ideas, and it's not a statement about...
It's not reflective of a broader view or a market-level view.
No, it generally isn't. And it's very interesting because most people would take our position as being very cautious on markets. I don't think a 12-month view on markets is of great value from anyone, and I certainly don't think I have great insight into that, but because of the sort of things we're talking about with easier liquidity and whatever, my best guess is markets are probably going higher this year until, the next problem arises.
Well, let's talk about one of the major differences that people attribute to the two firms, how you position. They often see Magellan as a bit of a proxy or exposure to more to US markets and Platinum with a specialty in Asia. A question's come through from some of our readers saying, where do you want to place your bets? Like, US versus Asia. And there's been this period of really strong US leadership. More recently, Asian markets had a challenging time. How do you think about that country and that geographic allocation and where you see the opportunities within those different markets? Hamish, the bias towards the States?
Well, first of all, I'd say there is just a huge misunderstanding about what we do that is biased to the US. It's domiciled to the United States, without a doubt. 70% of our portfolio is domiciled to the United States. But the vast majority of those businesses are very large multinational businesses. We have very, very little cyclical exposure in the United States, where we're taking a US view on the US economy dramatically outperforming.
Yep.
Actually, we've sold down most of what we'd call our US domestic style exposure in the portfolio. We've got businesses. The example I often give is, Nestlé is a Swiss company and it's got 2% of its sales in Switzerland, but it has nearly 35% of its sales in the United States of America. We don't own Coca-Cola at the moment for various reasons, but Coca-Cola is the kind of quintessential American company, and it has a bit over 20% of its business coming out of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone would say that if you own Coke, that you've got a US bet on, and if you own Nestle, you may have a European bet on. It's just complete nonsense at the end of the day. Ours, because of the nature of very market-leading firms like Google and Facebook and Apple and Nestle and others, they're operating everywhere, as in Visa and MasterCard. Some of them may not have businesses in China, like Visa and MasterCard don't have businesses in China, but then we've got Starbucks, which is a big business that is 60% of its future growth is probably going to be driven by their Chinese business over the next decade. So in no way are we, sometimes we have an expressed a view of a particular economic zone where we may be buying banks in a particular area of the world, or a more cyclical banker kind of cyclicals, or other things, some retailers, we may buy domestic retailers because we're taking an economic view. But we've got a very neutral economic view in the portfolio, notwithstanding we've got this big domicile view at the moment. We don't tend to have a lot of what we call economically cyclical things in the portfolio. And that may well be a difference wherever that we are at the moment. But this whole US, non-US, and also this thing that the US market is more expensive than other markets around the world. If you look at the S&P 500's average price earnings multiple, yes, it looks more expensive. But if you look at the underlying sectors of the market and you compare similar companies in America, and we just had Micron, which is a US company, but its PE multiple was incredibly low. And they've bought that over maybe some other memory businesses in the world because they decided that US one. They sell the memory all around the world. So even though, and Andrew's not taking a US view on that.
Mainly in China is where they sell it.
And he's not taking a US view on that, yet that's a US company. He's done it because, and when you look around, some of the big, within sectors, some of the cheaper ones are actually the ones listed in America. It's just the American actually index is far more skewed now to like very large technology, which trade at higher multiples as a whole. And therefore this whole thing of these commentators about markets simply are just not that inefficient.
This is absolutely correct. So I think we've missed, we've always thought the way you want to look at the world is, and it's the way our teams are set up, is they're industry specialists, and you can't do Micron without knowing Samsung, Hynix, SanDisk, the lot. So you can't do Sanofi without knowing what Merck is doing in the US. And this is exactly the case, that the US is expensive because of these large tech stocks. There's some differences. I think the US banks are generally a lot more expensive than banks around the world, but you'll get but then conditions for banks have been much better in the US.
Although I'd actually tell you, if you actually look at the big US banks and you look at their average price multiples compared to the non-Chinese large banks in the world, the multiples are very, very similar at the moment.
They probably are, but
if you adjust them for the return on equity, their price to books probably for the right return on equity is probably not that far out. The US was, they've come off quite a bit lately.
So I'm not following that closely, but I think some of the banks exposed to Eastern Europe, which is a really healthy environment, you know, we're talking of stocks that are, you know, got growing loan books and on book value and 7x earnings, and or you can go to somewhere at a stressed economy like Italy and get the great bank Intesa, and they're paying out all their earnings, you're getting a 10% yield. Now, it's not the most exciting investment, because if that's all you're going to get, I wouldn't own it. You need some economic growth to make it a sensible investment. But anyway, they're probably, I'm looking at particular banks rather than the big, you know, yes, the large European banks are pretty dull, I think, or in line. But it is this thing, it's not about the geography in most cases. Yes, there'll be domestic US business, domestic Chinese businesses that are facing their own factors, but it is really about, you know, we need to be looking at the world on an industry basis.
And that's why we're global investors. And true global investors would look at the world that way.
Right,
So what do you think are some of the really exciting long-term global industries, you know, that you think have got this multi-year growth cycle ahead of them? Where are you seeing the really strong tailwinds, the really attractive longer-term picture at the moment, if we take a positive view on a particular industry that you think is, regardless of the economic backdrop, is really just going to be a major player over the next 5 or 10 years?
Well, if I picked one big one that we're still in very early stages, I'd put cloud computing. The shift of computing power in the world, and there are going to be very, very few huge infrastructure players in the world with the deep capability. So outside of China, we probably have three very large-scale players now in the world. Amazon with AWS obviously is one. Number two is sitting in Azure, which is owned by Microsoft, and three in the world is Google Cloud, obviously owned by Alphabet. We're at a very, very early stage, probably in a $1 trillion addressable market. If you look over the next decade. That's going to be a massive industry. To get into that, you probably, and of course there's participations in that, and we may hear something on semiconductors and other things, how to participate that. But I think an industry of the future, of the shift of computational power to the cloud, and even things like driverless cars and things, that's all going to be powered by ultimately cloud-based technology, and then you've got the chips and you've got the software and everything that goes into that. So, you know, we've been in some ones that have still got very long tailwinds. We've been payments for a long period of time. There's still this massive shift. You know, global consumption expenditure probably grows at 6%, but these big payment networks are probably growing at around 12. PayPal's a bit faster, but big Visa and MasterCards, because you've still got this massive shift out of payments of cash and check. You know, when you have something delivered online, when is the last time you paid cash on delivery or a check on delivery? It, and all that is, everything that's going online has to be paid digitally now in the world. So that is still, even though it's been going on, it's got a very long a tailwind. But the big emerging one that I think is just massive in terms of scale, I'd probably put the shift to the cloud. And there's all sorts of different ways. You could be in the software as a service. You can be the infrastructure providers. You could probably be in the semiconductor space.
Could you give me, I'll come to you in a second, give me an example of, you know, often people like to say, so what's changing, what's a new piece of technology, what's being enabled by cloud computing that really captures your imagination? I imagine you meet with these big companies that you're talking about, and they're working on projects out the side. Like, what are some of the things that you've seen when you've been out researching these companies and understanding their capabilities that have really sort of blown your mind in terms of change with how we're going to be living and interacting in the world?
Well, I think we're just seeing it in a very simple sense. Now we're worrying about cybersecurity and security and everything. These big cloud providers can provide much better security for the future than we can provide by investing in our own systems on premise, because they can be automatically patched, for instance. And a lot of these cyber attacks that have happened have attacked from very large companies with on-premise software that simply forgot to patch. Or if you operate in 80 countries in the world, it's very, very hard to continuously patch all your different software and everything on the basis. So they're very practical examples. But of course, once you shift of that model and you get software as a service, and you shift to that, you're then in a very annuity style business. So I think powered by the cloud, you're going to see the Internet of Things, of course, where we're going to get massive amounts of connected devices all through our homes. You look at your photos on your phones at the moment, every photo, they're all stored in the cloud. There's very things happening in your life every single day. Ultimately, we'll get to a world, I believe, of driverless cars. I think they'll start out as taxi fleets. So I think personal driverless cars are a long way out from where we're sitting today. But the shifts there and the impact it's going to have on people is going to be absolutely immense. We're right at the 1.0 of what the shift to the cloud means for business models and just how we do things in our day-to-day lives.
Do you get excited by the same change?
Well, I mean, absolutely. The sort of cloud is enabling all sorts of interesting things, even within software. So that issue of security, for example, you know, interesting company. We don't own it. It's pretty well loved. Zscaler, which is using a cloud-based solution to provide security for companies around their existing systems. It's a very, very clever solution. I think it was been adopted. It's either Siemens or GE who are using it. So there's these amazing, you know, companies coming out of nowhere because of it, and you know, quite extraordinary. But there's lots of elements. There's to the excitement that's out there, whether it's artificial intelligence, which autonomous vehicles is probably one of the most interesting elements of that, and even, you know, it doesn't have to be fully autonomous, but it's the, you know, what the features you get on a high-end BMW or Audi or Merc as they come down, you know, through the range of vehicles, electric vehicles, renewables, you know, lots of interesting things going on there. And then another area is biotech, where, you know, we've got some extraordinary science at the moment coming up with all sorts of potential solutions for human health. And
what's an example of a step change in that part of the world?
Oh, look, it is honestly, it's, you know, we've got Bianca Ogden, who, you know, came out of the research labs at J&J, and, you know, worth an interview on her own to do justice to any of those ideas, because, you know, really, it's one of the areas where lay people really struggle to explain anything well. But, you know, we've seen, you know, and it's quite a, been a popular idea in the last year or two, but gene editing or whatever to, you know, try and, you know, change people's, you know, response to, you know, own genetic response and So there's a huge area. So there's all these different things that are, and again, we're the contrarian, but the other thing we love is where there's change going on, because to us, it's where you can't extrapolate. Like if you can say, oh, here's this company, it's grown at 5% forever, and it's going to keep growing at 5% forever. Well, if it does, it's probably the case everyone has a pretty good sense of that. But wherever there's technology and change going on, so I mean, as an example, people are very bearish about the auto companies for a whole range of reasons. Autonomous, the costs of going electric, which is being forced on them by both the European and Chinese regulators. You know, it's been a massive cycle. We're at the end of the cycle, and we probably are. But, you know, it's when you change products that you create the opportunity for the good companies to make money. So I think there's a very good chance that the boring old car companies, particularly a BMW or a Daimler, are going to make a lot of money out of selling electric vehicles, and there becomes the upgrade cycle. Well, you know, I've got my current BMW, but now there's one with, you know, hybrid electric, or it's got more autonomous features or whatever. And these are the things that, you know, these kind of changes drive opportunities.
Yeah. So I asked each of you to bring along a question, take me out of the frame, and to pitch a question to each other. So Andrew, you got a chance to ask Hamish a question that you've you know, want to put to him. So why don't you let
go easy, Andrew?
So I think I'm always interested when people come in to investment management from another area. I think it's a sort of a funny industry, and there's a lot of things about it that, you know, are unusual. And I was just interested in your, you know, you've had enormous success with Magellan, but I'm just interested in what are the perspectives you think, you know, your former work, you know, brought or gave you, you know, coming in into this industry?
Well, I it's a really interesting question. I think it gave us two real things. How we organised our research was very much an investment banking sort of model, where we set it up in global sort of sector basis. And you've set it up in sector, but a lot of global managers do not set themselves up on a sector. They set it up in a very generalist or a country view of the world. And we came in with a view that it had to be a sector basis. And really, we wanted very smart, very analytical people in that sort of research area, and we kind of built it pretty large from the start. So that was probably a lesson I took out of it. We did a lot of sort of valuations in terms of when we're investment banks on the advisory side, and we spent a lot of time interacting with management around strategy. So when we came in, we really thought about the strategy of the companies, and we got our analysts thinking about the strategies of the company. So that was pretty positive from investment bankers, but there's not all positives in investment banking. Here, you know, what we kind of didn't want to do is create an investment banking culture. Partnership is not a concept that really exists inside an investment bank. All the incentives are completely skewed for bad outcomes for other stakeholders. Yes. In it, and we actually employed very, very few people from the investment banking industry. So what we said is, look, we've seen the good and we've seen the bad on investment banking. So we really tried to extract the good. And I would actually say a focus on risk as well was probably the other thing. Not the investment banks turned out to be incredibly good, but the focus on risk is important, and how we arranged our sort of our research efforts. But what we really said is we don't want an incentive system that would cause certain types of behaviour. So we get very, very focused on how we create the right incentives inside and the culture within Magellan. And we almost wanted to be the polar opposite of what we saw on investment banking.
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting point, because, you know, we've always seen that what's important for us in coming to a decision is this internal debate about the idea. But to have an open and honest debate about ideas, you've got to know that your team members are all coming at it with a genuine interest in getting the answer, not proving their point or knocking your stock out of the portfolio. Or, you know, if you get internal competition, we compete with the world, and we all at Platinum, we all, I think, like competing and winning. But internally, we're on the same team. And you know, I think, you know, getting those incentives right and getting that culture right is really a very, very important.
Andrew, I'd be very interested maybe to reflect on, you know, an investment mistake in your career that you've done and really what sort of lessons you took out of it. You know, I think learning from our own mistakes is we all make them.
Yep.
But what something has stood out in your career of a mistake, and what's a sort of lesson you or you think investors should take out from that?
Yeah. So it's a great question. And I, you know, the way I like to think about this is, you know, the biases that we have that lead to these mistakes. And, you know, one of the classic problems that all humans have is confirmation bias. So we see in every bit of information that comes along the right outcome for what we're doing. And it's sometimes very easy to see in others when they're doing it, very hard to see it in yourself. So, you know, along the way, you know, people always like individual stock stories about this, and I can think about, you know, many, many years ago, you know, we had a significant investment in Indonesia in residential property development, and this thing was, you know, beautiful, had this great land bank, it was trading well below a, you know, NAV and da-da-da, but what came along was the, you know, the Asian crisis. The currency fell 90%, and this company had a small loan in US dollars that became a very massive one. And it's just, you know, you sort of look at the behaviour. It's a very simple example from long ago, but I get worried when I see companies doing that things that just sort of like, why are you buying that? Or why are you doing that? Doesn't make sense. And it might only be small and you can ignore it, but it's often a symptom of something else that's going on in their world. And I think you particularly see it in M&A where they go into something that sort of half makes sense, but is it really? Is there really a coherent thought there? And I think it often indicates that a company's can sort of see the writing on the wall with their ongoing business, even if it's 4 or 5 years out. So, but in aggregate, it's sort of like that confirmation bias is just something that we're all fighting all the time, I think.
Oh, I completely agree with you.
What techniques do you use to, for you as well, Hamish, what sort of techniques do you use to manage your biases? Because it's probably one of the things that comes up most consistently within our readership as something that they feel like they're susceptible to. Do you use specific techniques or are you just aware of it?
I think, you know, there are some sort of tools that you can use, but really for us, it's about having this, you know, very robust internal debate and an insistence that you write the case down for why you're doing what you're doing. And the reason I find that very powerful, it's probably more powerful for the introverts amongst us, is that you can talk in great terms about this company and why it's extraordinary and it's going to be a great opportunity, but the moment you start writing it down, you start going, oh, can I say that? So I think, you know, we then will, you know, get that case on paper, we'll debate it and try and get many, you know, different points of view there. And then we haven't, because we have a number of portfolios who can all own the same stock, one of the most interesting things that we have is that if I'm buying Micron but Clay Smolinski's not, or Alex Barbie, who runs our tech fund, is not, we're all experienced investors. We've all got access to exactly the same information and debate and discussion, but we come up with different points of view. That's worthy of a very, you know, significant effort to try and pull that apart. Now, we don't go to consensus. Sometimes, I mean, we will have those differences and we let them stay, but you certainly don't want, you know, there's a lot of unstated. Experienced investors will look at a situation and go, I don't really like that. That's not very helpful. You need to get out of them why they don't like it. What is it in their experiences that's leading them to that that conclusion? So they're, you know, that's essentially the process that, you know, we use internally to try and come to remove those problems, but they still remain.
Hamish, do you suffer any biases as an investor, or some that you find yourself repeat patterns of behaviour that you have when it comes to putting stocks in the portfolio or managing the fund?
Look, in terms of heuristic biases, it's something that I've always been incredibly focused on. It's very hard because we're hardwired and naturally to have these biases, to take shortcuts and do certain things. You know, if people went to the front page of our website, one of the things I wrote a long time ago was a whole series of investing biases that I think are very important. I often reread them and I often resend them to the team. There's a series of probably the more important ones. Here, confirmation bias, if of course, one, I'd put sort of groupthink very much in the confirmation bias. And what worries me more is when we kind of get everyone on the same page on a topic. So, and I'm very sensitive to when we're starting to get groupthink, but that's probably one of the most dangerous ones, when you start getting a whole lot of people who have a conviction that we're right, and there's not kind of a voice saying, hey, hang on.
Yeah.
And that can be dangerous. Another one I would say is oversimplification is a problem, and therefore things that are incredibly complex. And a lot of banks are incredibly complex, and sometimes I would sit down and I will read a 400-page 10K on a bank, just as a reminder about how little you actually understand about them, which is a thing. You can be simplified into investment case and look at price to book multiple and everything else, but sometimes you need a reminding of just how much you really understand. There's other biases, anchoring biases here. I think we're fairly good at not being anchored. You know, I have a team around me to try and overcome some biases. I've chosen their personality. Some of them will deliberately take contrary views nearly all the time to mine, but with analytics, so I think that's very important that you're testing the other cases. And something I've learned a lot about is another bias I've written about is neglect of probability. And you know, I've made mistakes. I think the biggest mistake I made around Brexit on neglect of probability, we held some investments in the UK. All the opinion polls were telling us that the Remain vote would get through. We had some investments there. And because of all that information was coming in that looked very likely it was in, the problem is that the polls were very close, but everyone thought it would be slightly over 50%, which means there was almost a 50% probability that something else was going to happen. And the something else was going to happen was potentially very ugly in terms of what would happen to the pound. And we owned Lloyds Bank at the time in that. And that was an experience about assessing the probabilities and actually really looking at the alternative cases when the probabilities are anywhere material. But you know, some of these, that was a bias. And I always talk about probabilities and scenarios, and one that was staring me in the face, it was so obvious, lo and behold, your biases came in and we got it wrong.
Yeah.
I wouldn't use we, I put I got it wrong.
Yeah. I really like your comment, Hamish, about, you know, when everyone's sort of convinced that this is a great idea. And so, you know, we have our stock meetings, and I'd say the best ones are when, you know, there'll be 5, 6, 7 people there. And if 7 people walk out of the room going, this is great, it's invariably terrible because they haven't seen, you know, the weak side of the case. The best ones are where generally, you know, the analyst is firm in their view, they've done the work, they've spent, you know, weeks, months potentially going through the case, and at best they just manage to drag the PMs over the line to do something. They're invariably the good ones, because if you don't have some of that, you know, in uncertainty around why this is good, you know, it's sort of obvious to the world.
The uncertainty that creates the opportunity to price,
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
Listen, we're going to wrap up because we've got a few of the audience questions which we're going to run through. So the rules here are we need to keep it pretty short and sharp.
A problem with both of us. So.
Yeah.
Guilty as charged.
All right, well, we're talking about global investing, currency movements. How do you manage the risk or the opportunity with regards to currency, Andrew?
So look, we see our neutral position as having no hedges on. If we're in Japanese stocks, we'll be exposed to the yen. But there will be occasions where, you know, we really think currencies are at an extreme, and they actually may be giving you opportunities. For example, the yen's been very strong in the past. It was a great opportunity to buy exporters, but you obviously want to take the view that the yen will weaken out of the equation, so you'll hedge it. Other examples would be in China at the moment, where we have a significant exposure. One of the release valves for that economy, if really things do not unfold well, would be to let their currency weaken. And so if that doesn't happen and the currency is a bit stronger, that's fine, but we've hedged some of that out because I think our stocks will be doing very well. But on the other side, if the currency does weaken, you know, we're protected from that. So, but by and large, you want to sort of have a very strong view for doing anything in currencies. I think if you're playing around here and there based on your view on rates or growth or whatever, I think that's a zero-sum game for the market and for those who participate in that. It's, yeah, I think you're more likely to give away.
Well, first of all, I'd say is any long-term investor shouldn't get too concerned about the currency. And the reason I say that is because currencies don't compound at the end of the day. They have one-off sort of adjustments around their mean. So if you're looking over to get a 10% return per annum, and you achieve that over time, that means every 7 years your portfolio is doubling, but a 20% currency movement is going to take 20% off a doubling, assuming you've at the starting point to the end point you've had that adjustment. And taken in the context on a per annum basis, that currency shift in a long-term portfolio just isn't that material. I think there is a genuine diversification benefit to having some unhedged currency exposure because we live in a country with a commodity-related currency and tends to what happens when the world has a real problem, the A-dollar tends to fall, and when the A-dollar's falling, your offshore investments back in A-dollars are worth more, so you tend to get a bit of a protection around that. I can agree with Andrew. At the extremes, when the dollar was at parity, you'd be mad to have had any sort of currency hedges on. If the dollar's at 60 cents, you could. We don't actively manage that outside our high conviction strategy around those extremes, but they can be quite obvious. And we offer both a currency hedged and unhedged product, so you could actually switch between it at those extremes. But I think you can get overly caught up. There is a genuine diversification benefit, and overly caught up the difference between the compounding effect of the earnings growth of the companies versus a one-off adjustment of the currency. And it's over a long period of time, it's actually not that material.
No, that's absolutely right.
Next question. ETF flows and the growth of them, have they created more opportunities for active management?
Look, I wouldn't say it's just ETFs. I think by definition, the more and more of the market that goes to ETF, there's fewer and fewer active managers that are going to be there. And I think for active management, that's actually a good thing for people who are skilled in running portfolios. By definition, it's going to have to make the markets more efficient. If everything went to passive, even the bad companies, nothing would be reflecting the price. So the markets would be completely inefficient if everything was 100% passive. So just by definition, more and more markets that's been taken up passive, there's less room for as many active firms. I'd also argue what's happening with MiFID II, effectively putting a cost on research and making research effectively a barrier to entry for smaller, bright teams who spin out, who are going to have to pay for their own research. That is also potentially going to make the markets more inefficient. It's probably very good for a Platinum or Magellan who's got the capability to hire people. We pay for our own research and it doesn't worry us at all, MiFID II. But there's a number of things that ultimately are probably leading to some skilled active managers, creating that this industry is always going to exist in the future.
I think the move, if we think of ETFs as passive, you know, that's our opportunity, that there's less and less people looking for these opportunities. I'd actually say that one of the really interesting things about passive, and, you know, you sort of can't deny the logic of, you know, the average active manager doesn't outperform over time.
But which definitionally has to be correct.
Right. But it doesn't answer the question of whether I should be in the market or not. And I think at the core of probably both our investment approaches is not, we're not there saying, we're expected to do better than the market, but that's not what we're trying to do. I'm saying to you that Micron today, I think, has an implied return of the order of 20 to 30% per annum over the next 5 years. You would have a sense of what you're expecting from Facebook or whatever, but we're making that judgment on that stock against, you know, if you like, US 10-year or the Australian 10-year, whatever it is. I think it will do better than the market through time. But if you're going to go passive, you're assuming that you're going to make money from the market. Well, ask a Japanese investor who went passive in 1989 how that went for them. You know, it's not surprising that passive is not very popular in that
part of the world.
That part of the world.
All righty.
So these aren't the short answers.
We're going to go this geographically, Asia or America. Which area has the brightest future?
I think both the US and China have extraordinary potential. They are the two dynamic economies in the world. That's where opportunities come from. There's a reason for Silicon Valley's existence. There's a reason why China is doing so well in many of the same areas. I think they're the two great opportunities.
It's not binary, it's not one or the other.
It's not. And then you'll see other parts of Asia, Japan, you know, the economy is doing better, but it doesn't have that dynamism that those two places have, nor does Italy, you know. But then somewhere like Germany is pretty good. So I think it's all about, you know, the world we're in, you need that entrepreneurial zeal and the desire to, you know, find the new thing.
Yeah, I would very much agree with Andrew. We are very bullish on the long-term outlook for China and the opportunities, the Chinese economy. It's a massive economy with a massive educated population with a growing and probably will be the world's largest domestic market. And just the US has currently got the world's largest domestic market. So I think both of those economies have massive long-term strategic advantages. But at the end of the day, it's not about investing in economies, it's about investing in individual companies.
Yep.
At present, I would say for various reasons, some of the leading American companies have an edge. From governance reasons, from talent reasons, from incentive systems, from a whole series of things. But there are going to be great Chinese companies that come up through that with the massive sort of domestic market and everything they have and the technology and the education system in China. And there can be some amazing businesses in China. But, you know, on a global scale at the moment, many of the very large leading American companies do have do have an edge, and those edges aren't going to suddenly disappear overnight.
Very quickly, you got up to the top of your cash threshold, or what the fund is in the mandate, that 20% level. Would you have liked to have been able to go higher?
Look, at the end of the day, in our core product, which is the Magellan Global Fund, cash is a risk position as well. So, you know, holding very substantial amounts of cash for extended periods of time, it's a 20% position at max in our portfolios. So people have to understand cash isn't some sort of riskless asset. It's not going to earn our investment returns through cycle by taking very large positions in cash. And I wouldn't go anywhere near 20% in a single stock. So I think it's a pretty substantial part of an equity portfolio, 20%. I feel very comfortable. Now, high conviction fund, I can go greater than that, but that's kind of a very, very targeted, very, very, it's 8 to 12 stocks, so it's a very different thing. But in a core product, I think 20% is a big position to be taking in any single asset in your portfolio, and I feel very comfortable about that.
Andrew, after a tough 2018, how much capital is going back into Asia now?
From our perspective?
And outside of your own perspective?
Oh, look, I mean, you know, we have, as I was saying earlier, we've really been changing the portfolio over. So probably no more capital has gone into Asia than where we were a year ago, but some of the names have most certainly changed. But you know, we are, in terms of the market, you are seeing today the early signs of a pickup from investors coming back into Hong Kong and the Chinese A-share market. That's starting to happen, but you never know whether that goes on.
Okay. Final question for each of you. What's the most significant opportunity in the market that no one is talking about?
I would keep coming back to these semiconductor companies that we've been buying. To be buying these companies that are at the core of everything we do. And yes, they're cyclical to a degree. But okay, today we're probably paying 30% above book value, but all because we're scared about the year ahead. Earnings are going to be down this year. But the valuations, I have not seen valuations for companies of this quality in my 30 years. I just think they're extraordinary, and there's a whole grouping of companies around them that I think are very similarly very, very cheap.
Right. Hamish?
Well, I really can't answer that question, James, because I'm not really aware of a big, big opportunity that actually no one's talking about, whether people have valued it correctly or not. Obviously, there's massive uncertainty about future regulation and things that creates a... People are all over that debate in terms of technology and things of where that is. I would actually argue in the big cloud computing side of things, I don't think people understand the duration of it. So everyone's talking about it, but I don't think many people really focus on a decade or 20 years. In terms of really the scale of the investment opportunity. So while people are talking about it, that's what I'm saying, I can't really answer the question, because many people are talking about it. I don't think people get the duration of the investment opportunity and can value that to the scale that it is. But is anyone not talking about it? No, there's not many things we're looking at that I don't think people sometimes have what we call duration arbitrage. They don't actually get the value and the duration of it because markets tend to be much more short-term focused. But am I saying we've identified something like this and no one else has worked it out? No, because we take a longer-term view, we actually can see value that others aren't prepared to invest in. But it's not like we've got an insight that we're the only people in the world who
I think we're in a world now, you know, maybe... 25 years ago, people hadn't talked about, you know, a new emerging market or some thing that was happening in tech. But today, I mean, we are saturated in, you know, so there's nothing much left undiscussed.
You mentioned gene editing. Gene editing is incredibly, and gene therapy and things, you know, Novartis is in both these spaces, incredibly exciting, and you can do a lot of research. And you probably find great opportunities by doing that. But it is something no one's talked about.
No, everyone's talking about it. It's just a question of what they're, you know, whether they actually have the insight as to where the final destination is.
A fair answer. Well, gentlemen, thank you both for presenting the opportunity to come and have a chat with two great Australian global investment firms, and appreciate your candour and taking on the challenge of putting a few questions to each other as well. So thank you very much.
No, thank you.
Thanks, James. Thank you.